Hello, and welcome to Till Dice Do Us Part. I'm George.
And I'm Ailsa. We're here with another episode of the podcast where we share our thoughts from decades of reading, playing and running RPGs to answer your dicey dilemmas and help your tabletop thoughts.
It's been a long time since we last did a full-length episode for a variety of reasons that we've mentioned in the minisodes, but we are back with a special episode for the end of the year.
So we've taken some time out of the last day of work at Till Dice Towers to prepare this Christmas special for you. Of course, it's been a while since we've spoken to you all, so you're probably wondering what everyone's been up to. Why don't we go round the building and do a quick summing up?
I think Twike, our social goblin, has had the toughest time. Everything going on at Twitter HQ these days with the change of ownership, the fluctuating rules, it's been like getting the rug pulled out from under her. She lives for retweets and follower engagements.
Yes, Twike not like that musky man messing around with the tweetses and the commentses. So Twike has to think about using Fastermon instead. Think musky man should go back to just spending time with his musician daughter Lady Grimes and that grandson she gave him that time he named after a plane.
Twike, love, that's not his daughter.
She was his what?
Yeah, that's Mrs. Shawnee there. As our head of HR, she's been trundling along with her usual tasks, including updating her health and safety documentation so that the Carnivorous Codex handling is explicitly included in her risk assessment and method statements after some incidents.
Tuppy was organising our Secret Santa, the presents for which we're actually about to open. Hope you have a nice Christmas plan, Tuppy. You going down south to see the rest of the Juniper Smythe clan?
Oh, yes. Thank you, darling. Yes, I'll be away for a few days, but hoping to be back before the new year. Or Hogman A, as you lot call it.
Yeah, that we do. What's been happening with you career-wise recently? Anyway, while we've been off air, are you doing much voiceover work?
A little, yes. It's been a bit rough out there, I must confess. I've still got my own podcast, of course.
Of course.
But other paid work has been a bit thin on the ground. People aren't spending so much on advertising these days. Even Frank and Bunty are having to tighten their belts.
Mm.
I did get the last two for probably the biggest role in my life, but unfortunately this German girl beat me in the final round.
Oh, that's a shame, Tappy, love.
I practiced my delivery for so long too. Granny, I got the job! Could have been my big break.
Maybe sometimes not getting the job is the real big break.
Is it time for us to open our Secret Santa presents anyway? Find out what we got?
Yes, let's!
How very charming.
Oh, look at that! The mailer demon got little Santa hat style horn warmers. It's like a cross between earmuffs and dilly boppers.
Won't you look just the thing the next round delivering mail through the nether realms? It's a much of a Christmas shutdown for the Mailer Demon Network, anyway.
Usually no, but actually we're on strike right now. An act of sympathy for the mortal message handlers and their industrial action.
Hashtag solidarity.
My present is a sheet of paper.
Is it a gift certificate?
No, it's proof of ownership of a Donald Trump digital trading card.
Someone got you an NFT for Christmas.
We'll never know who, I guess.
Yes, we won't. I guess it must be some sort of alpha male Chad with lots of crypto experience trying to do a beta cuck a favour by giving him a long-term investment.
The entire incel, ladies and gentlemen, who is still living in our floorboards. We had a period of grace when he was stuck in America, but he ended up back here.
Things weren't as good as they used to be there. It's hardly the land of the free anymore.
That's code for I got deported for using a racial slur.
Which is funny, because I thought they gave you a seat in the Senate for that.
Wonder what I got. It's more paper.
Oh god, it's not another NFT, is it? I hope yours looks better than mine does. I have Donald Trump riding a red semi-truck through a barricade marked Liberal Elites.
This certificate says you are now a paid-up member for one calendar year of the Custard of the Month Club.
The Custard of the Month? Ailsa, that is the gift that keeps on giving.
Maybe we should give our listeners their Christmas special.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
Yeah, about that.
What do you mean about that? We're in the studio. It's Christmas. We're recording an episode. What could possibly be about that? About that.
It's our summer special.
Sorry, I think I misheard you there.
Maybe he hasn't eaten enough custard. Goblin mums say it helps ears grow big. Good thing somebody got a subscription.
Summer special.
Summer special.
Summer.
George, darling.
Yes, honey.
Why is it a summer special?
Well, do you remember when we went on that cruise and, like, to Florida and stuff?
Why, yes, George, I do remember. It was my sister's wedding. Anyone who was following us on social media knew that. The 9 people who unsubscribed because they were not enjoying Twike's updates on social media. Well, good luck to them. But yeah, we went round a Disney cruise ship. We visited places in the Caribbean, some Florida theme parks. Yep. I mean, you can forgive me for not seeing the relevance to our Christmas special because it happened in July.
Which is traditionally part of summer.
That we agree on.
And we recorded a bunch of stuff while we were there, which we've never used because we haven't made a new episode since. And I kind of didn't want to waste any of it or wait till the next summer, so I'm doing it now.
A summer special in December.
I mean, look, people need warming up. They can't put their heating on anymore with the cost of living increases. So if you think about it, I could bring some summer sun into their lives in a purely auditory format.
Summer sun? Fine, you know what? It's fine. It's summer during Christmas in Australia, right? So if we just tell our listeners to stand on their heads, it'll be a veritable Antipodean Christmas.
Just like Neighbours.
Twike's still thinking about those 9 unsubscribers. They were not Team Twike.
What are these summary sections anyway?
Well, on the boat we recorded a ramble about world building and how transport is a thing to consider for your games. You know, we talked about how different vehicles, their speed, their availability, their cost, their safety can influence a bunch of elements in the game world. So I've put that in.
Oh yeah, and we also had that time we talked about Happiest Apocalypse on Earth, a horror role-playing game. It used that Powered by the Apocalypse system to give a story of weird goings-on at a theme park. It's coming back to me.
Yeah, you're going to do that. Tuppy had a promo for the second series of her own podcast, so I'll probably put that in the advert slot.
Lovely. And then hopefully we can do another episode in January where, I don't know, it'll be a Halloween or Diwali special at that point.
Time is an illusion. Podcast time doubly so. Okay then, on with the show.
Hello folks, you join us here in our stateroom on board the Disney Fantasy.
It's a sweet, sweet fantasy, baby, but judging by the noises coming from our bathroom, it's not as sweet a fantasy for some as it is for others.
No, Tuppy had booked us in to play mixed doubles tennis because it's a sea day and there's nothing else to do, but I don't think that's going to be happening.
Oh yes! Poor Mela Demon, he's rather under the weather. I don't think he's going to be up to tennis.
This unstable telluric currents in the water play havoc. I'm sorry, I need to go back to the bathroom.
I think it's best if we postpone, darlings.
Oh no, we're going to miss out on sports. That's a real shame, Tuppy. That's a real shame.
Oh, we're devastated.
I mean, look, there's not much else to do, right? I mean, there's bingo, there's the Disney quizzes.
We could just sit and watch the waves.
I mean, when you spend a lot of time on a mode of transport like this, it does make you think a bit about transport and vehicles and...
Is this a segue into a role-playing segment, George?
Just call me a motorised electric people-moving system, because I'm segue as all hell. That's right. We could choose to go do something else, like watching our Disney film, or we could talk about role-playing games while a demon vomits in our bathroom.
I mean, there is such a thing as too much family fun, so...
We crossed that a couple of days ago.
Yeah, here we are. We're doing role-playing stuff.
So, look, doesn't matter if you're playing a fantasy game, a science fiction game, a modern game. Different modes of transport will exist in your setting. How much, how fast, what is available, it all has big impacts on how the travel operates in your game world, and that has knock-on effects on a surprising amount of other areas.
Bear with us here, because we're not talking about how many light years a planet is away from Earth and how long it's going to take the Starship Enterprise to get there. That's just maths. What we're talking here is about more small-scale but still important things that will directly impact your characters and the world that they live in. So a really obvious thing, depending on what kind of transport you've got available in your game world, is availability of food. Is exotic food easy to come by in your game world? Is it hard to get? You know, has it got to come from abroad? Like, you know, once upon a time, pineapples were seen as a super luxurious thing only available to the super rich, and now you can get a tin of pineapple from Tesco.
I mean, remember, if it must be like a decade or so ago now, there was that Icelandic volcano that basically grounded all planes, and like, for a week, the supermarket shelves were missing half the things because, oh yeah, it turns out there's a lot of food that we don't grow here. We ship it in from our country that has the right climate from it.
So, yes, there were no bananas.
Ayo. Also, you know, how news and cultural trends travel. When you change the fastest method of transport available for you from 10 miles an hour to 100 miles an hour or 1,000 miles an hour, that has a big impact on how up-to-date the provinces of any given polity are with what's going on at the core. If it's going to take you 3 weeks or 3 hours or 3 minutes for London to tell Glasgow, oh, by the way, this guy's kicked out. Don't let him in the house again.
One of the things your party is going to be really interested in is probably availability of weapons and armour.
Ain't that the truth?
Even if you're a high-level epic character with all the money in the world, depending on how your game world's set up, it might take 6 months to ship that new dwarven plate mail armour that you've ordered by donkey wagon.
It's not necessarily uniform across your entire game setting. What methods of transport are available or more common might vary between different countries or cities or what have you. They can give locations a unique flavour, some unique personality. So, for example, here in Scotland, the capital city of Edinburgh has a tram network.
It's got a line.
I think it might have two now, but it's not very impressive. But they put this in about a decade ago, and it's a thing that they're the only city in Scotland that still has that. Glasgow's trams were gone decades ago. Glasgow does have, however, an underground system of trains.
I believe, is it the second oldest in the world?
It's after Paris or something.
It's at least 120 years old.
It's ancient.
I mean, again, it's very minimal. There's one line. But gosh darn it, we've got it, it runs, we've got an underground. And that is part of our personality.
Yeah.
But when you're thinking about, like, Amsterdam, you'd be thinking about the canals, the bicycles, and that all just adds to that laid-back personality of the city. Mm. You think about Paris, you think, oh, it's super chic, it's full of glamorous people zipping around on scooters. And of course, you can't mention London without mentioning the iconic red buses.
When we ran D&D, I did once have like a gnomish empire whose whole gimmick was being mercantile naval power. So I made their city based on Amsterdam. I described it as being full of canals, and that just immediately tells you, oh, boats are important to these people. And, you know, even the same mode of transport can mean very different things in different places. Ilsa, you have been on the Tokyo Underground, the London Underground, the New York Underground, and the Glasgow Underground. I do not think it was the same experience every time.
The Tokyo Underground was a lot cleaner.
Tokyo Underground was very clean and very efficient. The London Underground is very expansive. And some of the stations are quite characterful and big. The New York Underground...
I mean, I feared for my life at times.
I was scared so much as just going, oh.
Oh dear.
This is a first world country in theory. And Glasgow's underground. If you fall asleep in the train, it's fine. Half an hour, you'll be at the same station again. Doesn't matter. But yeah, look, there's lots of historical modes of transport that if you're playing a fantasy game are the likely methods that are getting used. Okay. So horses, boats, litters and palanquins, carriages, or just walking everywhere. These produce areas that are shaped the way that the maps of real Dark Ages and medieval places were assembled. locations had their journey times between each other thought of less in miles and more as X days ride away. Villages and cities and towns had the relationship between each other of how far it would take to walk or ride between them, because that's how you would ship goods between them.
So when you're building your fantasy world, don't just think about the cities and towns. Think about building things in between them, like coaching inns, places for your travellers to rest their horses, grab some food. And of course, the inn itself will be full of colourful characters, some of whom are transient, like merchants, entertainers, kind of people you might not necessarily find elsewhere, but might be still interesting for your characters to interact with.
There was at least one article for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying, which is specifically, here is an example coaching inn, typical of the many your characters will stop off at if they're going between these two major cities. So, yeah. Also, remember, like in our world, things like cars aren't just a form of travel. They can also be a social status thing. And that didn't just come out of nowhere. In a world where horses are your main form of travel, horses have all the social status, all the costs, all the general cultural implications that a car does. If your horse gets injured, if it breaks its leg, that's like your clutch going in your car. It's a big deal. It's going to impact the whole life. I mean, think about like in Pendragon, Ailsa, where depending on the period of history and the location the characters were in, different mounts were available, some of which were better or worse at certain things.
Yeah, I mean, part of the Great Pendragon campaign, which we're currently playing, involves travelling to Europe, where our players have found unique horse breeds that we haven't seen previously in our British stables. So I recently picked up a very expensive horse in-game, and it gives me a bonus to lance damage when I'm charging, which is awesome. But if anything happens to it now I'm back home, I can't exactly mail order another one.
No, Andalusia do not deliver to Gloucester on a daily basis. For longer distances, and especially for transcontinental journeys, sea travel was the only practical option. But this comes with its own problems. Now, despite the protestations coming from our bathroom by the mailer demon right now,
he's just not a fan of water in general.
Modern boat travel is quite safe, quite reliable. It's, you know, it's mostly predictable, some impact by weather, but everything's well charted. But a typical D&D game or another fantasy setting that's kind of boat heavy, like 7th Sea, riding on a big, like a great ship or a coracle, is not the same experience. These people will not have super accurate maps, super accurate clocks. They won't have as safe or reliable a source of food and drink as we have on this ship's many buffets.
Oh, the buffet is the best bit of this boat. I cannot tell a lie.
The shrimp for breakfast has been a game changer for Ailsa.
Now, obviously we're not saying that you need to micromanage how many biscuits are left in every player's pantry. You know, you don't need to micromanage each turn of the rudder. That's not what we're saying. But you can break it down into steps and make the journey itself part of the adventure. So this is an epic quest you're going on, so don't take that lightly. Something that you can do when you're trapped in an isolated environment on certain modes of transport, like a ship or a spaceship or whatever, there's no immediate means of escape, which means it can lend itself to a whole new kind of story. There's no shortage of media you can take inspiration from. I mean, you could go all Agatha Christie, you could do a murder mystery story like Murder on the Orient Express. Your players might need to solve the clues.
There's a long tradition in Doctor Who of bases under siege. You could very easily have a ship under siege.
Absolutely. You could bring in more supernatural elements. Like, if you've ever read Dracula, there's that bit in the middle of the novel that most people forget about and most film adaptations don't show, despite it being one of the best bits, where Dracula is on the boat and starts picking off the crew one by one. So you could have either somebody on board or an external entity that's attacking the ship, but you can't run away.
That ship in Dracula, is it Demeter?
Yes.
I think apart from the Stephen Moffat, Mark Gatiss version of Dracula.
Yeah, it's Kelly, usually skimmed over.
I don't think I've seen it that often, though. But yeah, like depending on how, I don't know, the druids' nature powers work, how they summon their animals. The fact you're at sea might mean I can't summon wolves, mate. I can summon all the sharks you want.
Power of the porpoise!
But if you're wanting a bear, then let me tell you, This bear is going to have a lot of problems if it's 1,000 miles into the Pacific Ocean.
Death by weevil.
But of course, all these discussions so far are based on historical stroke real world things. And once magic gets involved, things change. The wind in your sails, the fleetness of your horse, these are no longer the limits to the fastest possible travel methods.
You might have a magical mount like a griffin or a dragon. And I mean, they might not be faster than a horse per se, but they can, of course, easily soar over the top of a forest or a mountain with next to no fuss.
Yeah, good luck getting up Mount Everest on your charger horse, yeah.
Sure, teleportation or gate spells might be expensive, but a king or a general who needs to retreat quickly now has a feasible emergency escape plan.
I mean, even more lowly spells have big impacts on how a more medieval-style world would work. Like, take this, the message spell. I think in 5th ed D&D that's 3rd level. So a group's going to get there comparatively quickly. This is not an unobtainable spell. It lets you send a 25-word message instantaneously to anyone in the same plane of existence as you with no chance of failure. In a world that relied on sending messengers days, weeks, potentially months to get to ends of it, being able to just say to your wizard, in London, please let the Emperor of China know that I'd like to marry his daughter. That's, you know, that's a big deal.
They should be leading that with professionals. Honestly, it's taking jobs away from hard-working demons.
There, Tommy, don't get yourself in a fuss.
In most periods of history prior to 20th century, of course, the maximum speed of travel pretty much was the maximum speed of communication.
Yeah.
Once you change that by, you know, whatever kind of magic, you've effectively given people the telegram or the telephone.
Or God help you, you've given them Twitter.
With all the social changes that implies.
And there's also a difference between what the campaign world has more generally and what your player characters have. Because most people in the world may be relying on horse or boat, but if your players are high level enough and are packing teleport and can ride dragons, that's still a deal.
Well, in our D&D game, we ended up at epic level to the point where we could teleport to anywhere we'd been previously or that we'd seen through a scrying spell, which basically meant anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, that's fine. It's like if you've ever played like one of the classic Pokemon games where you get the fly move and suddenly your character can zip around between cities instantly rather than having to slog through the tall grass. Up until the recent games, this had to be earned. You had to trudge your way along Route 1, fight those Rattatas. You had to work your way up until you could, you know, you'd played enough game to achieve the fly spell. Yeah, that controlled your initial movements. It made sure that you were going along the right path. You would never encounter a Pokemon or any opponents that were too high level for you that you couldn't compete with. It did railroad the narrative a bit. I think that's why the most recent Pokemon game is much more open world. You can choose to do what encounters you want in whatever order you want. Now, this is going to come down to personality. Different players will respond positively or negatively to that open world versus closed world concept. Some will get overwhelmed with all the options, option paralysis, and faff around. So be careful if you're going to do that.
Oh yeah, like when we can talk about it more another time if we ever review the Traveller role-playing game. But I do recall that the kind of freedom that having a spaceship with no clear chain of command and you could fly wherever you want,
it can just turn into a big argument.
Even if only a couple of people have it, that still has an impact. You know, not many people may have flown by Concorde, but Concorde's existence still had an impact on a lot of other people's life in a sideways way. Going back a second to science fiction, is that maybe a thing for us to mention, Ilsa?
So, yeah, I mean, we've mostly been talking about fantasy so far, but a lot of those same considerations do still apply to the science fiction setting as well.
Oh, yeah. The speeds of transport's faster. The ships are more likely to be captained by blonde women in cat suits with beehive hairdos that ask you to show them this earth thing you call kissing. But, you know, they still have a method of transport whose speed and reliability sets the tone of the setting. in something like Star Wars, say, even very small fighter craft that only have one person in them can travel by hyperspace. So an individual can move between planets, between stars, kind of covertly. Luke can just drop everything and go to the Dagobah system in The Empire Strikes Back. And from his point of view, that's no different to just, like, you know, getting in a Fiat Punto and going for a drive down to Lark's.
I mean, another sci-fi setting you might consider is Babylon 5. So within that, there's a network of jump gates. Now, that allows civilians and smaller crafts to travel between major hubs. But only the bigger military craft have the technology to go far from the jump gates and explore systems themselves. The balance of power is then changed, however, in the story when they meet an enemy who can easily create their own jump points, which puts the humans on the back foot. I mean, the most popular sci-fi settings that we've mentioned there are also fairly soft sci-fi, for want of a better word. Travel time is very much proceeding at whatever speed the plot requires it to.
How long does it take Picard to get anywhere?
It's however long he needs to get there. And that's fine. You know, in our Star Trek game, we just arrive whenever George tells us we do. It could be an hour, it could be 4 weeks. It's just whatever the narrative demands. Feel free once again to use that travel time to have a different sort of adventure. Star Trek had a lot of what they call bottle episodes that take place entirely on the ship. You could do a holodeck episode, you could do the one where they're all trying to put on a play or a saxophone concert, you know, you get the idea.
Night Bird.
Harsh.
Of course, harder science fiction settings and games do exist, and mentioned earlier their Traveller, which has a much kind of more hard sci-fi vibe, and Travel similarly has rules and cultural implications that are based on much harder sci-fi concepts. When you guys played, you had that freedom to travel anywhere you want, but travel once wasn't instantaneous. It was going to take you, like, at least a month to get between any two star systems, and your plan had to account for that. Unlike the subspace radio of Star Trek, where you can just call 80 light years with no lag, Traveler has no faster than light communication system. The fastest method of communication is also the fastest method of travel. They're called X-boats. They basically have super fast mail ships. Think like space DHL.
Oh, do they tell you that they've left your parcel on a neighbouring planet?
But yeah, in the Third Imperium setting, this means that even super urgent news can only go as fast as an X-boat goes. It might take months for the centre of government to get all the fringes of the Empire to know what the latest intergalactic news is.
I mean, it could be pretty big, like a new law has been passed. I mean, the Emperor could have died and been replaced, but the colonies at the outskirts simply won't know that for a substantial amount of time, meaning shenanigans can ensue.
Speaking of shenanigans, science fiction and magic do not have to be kept mutually exclusive and can absolutely combine for travel shenanigans. Space travel in Warhammer 40,000, for example, works in a process that, let's see, how will I describe it? Beating the theory of relativity by taking a shortcut through hell.
Is that a technical term?
They go through the warp, the immaterium, basically like the parallel universe where all demons live. Because the laws of physics and time don't apply in this magic world, they can cheat and go faster than they could in the normal space.
Are you two talking about Warhammer 40,000?
Yes, we are.
That perpetuates lots of very negative stereotypes about my people.
Oh, I'm really sorry. But shall we just move on?
I'll try and downplay it. Look, just traveling by like that magical hell gateway brings up a whole bunch of other problems. For example, you need a magic using or psychic person to navigate the ship. Satnav does not cover the nether realms.
So it's basically like the navigators in Dune, right?
It's very like the navigators from Dune in a please do not sue way. If your navigator gets injured or dies, then, you know, congratulations, you're now flying through hell blind. Let us know how that goes.
If your ship's magical defences fail mid-journey, there's a risk things might go a little bit event horizon.
Oh, have you ever seen Event Horizon, Tuppy?
No, I don't believe I've had the pleasure.
It's a real feel-good comedy, you'll love it.
And because this travel is based on magic rather than scientific principles, travel time can be erratic. You could arrive 100 years later than expected, or 100 years before you set off with all the problems that implies.
I know a song about that, by the way.
You know a song about space travel and time travel?
I do. It's a Queen song.
What?
I only discovered this recently, right? But there's a song on the, I think it's a Night at the Opera album called 39. And when I was wee, I used to love this song because it's got a really kind of upbeat, jolly tune. And I never really thought too hard about the lyrics, but it's written by Brian May, who is an actual, like,
astrophysicist.
And it's about time travel and the theory of relativity. A ship takes off from Earth because the planet's doomed. They're trying to find a new world to colonize. They go faster than the speed of light. They come back a year later, but 100 years have passed on Earth and everybody that they knew has died.
Now, I bet you weren't expecting the crossover of time travel and Queen on this podcast, but here we are.
But is there nothing that band can't do? I'm going to put that song up on social media. It's great.
Please do. You could, there's other ways to merge fantasy and scientific principles. China Mevil wrote, amongst other things, Perdido Street Station, which is initially looks a more traditional fantasy setting with more Victoriana elements in it. But there's a lot of steampunk elements, including a magically powered train system. Perdido Street Station is one of many stations in the city of Bas-Lac. So, you know, it's you can absolutely mishmash in.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be one or to other.
You could have a lightning rail powered by elementals or whatever.
Lightning rail, lightning rail, lightning rail.
I gave my lightning rails to Alhambra, Neverwinter, and Kryn, and it certainly so put them on the map. But yeah, look, the other thing to remember about travel is the more extreme the environment you're traveling through, the greater the risk to the travellers if their transport method is lost or breaks down. Let's imagine, Ilsa, a typical fantasy elven ranger. La-di-da-di-dee! I've got my horse. I've got my beautiful white horse and my bow, and I'm riding through an... Oh no! My horse has been killed by a goblin attack.
I mean, obviously your elf is going to be a little bit annoyed.
Yes.
But the game can feasibly continue. They can either keep walking or they can hitch a ride with another player till they get to the next city and buy another horse.
Yeah. However, if that same elf is with their adventuring party on a naval vessel, they get attacked by pirates and the boat starts sinking. No matter how good their doggy paddle is, right, they're probably about to be in a lot of trouble.
And about to spend a lot of time in a rowboat or on a tiny desert island.
One of those little, like, Far Side comic desert islands. Mm. Yeah.
With one palm tree.
With one palm tree. And if that same elf got very lost, somehow they're on board the USS Enterprise, NCC-1701-D. Romulan disruptor fire hits. The ship loses warp power, 200 light years away from the nearest starbase. I mean, it doesn't matter if the whole crew get out and push along with the elf at that stage. They're not going anywhere in a hurry. They're sitting ducks. When setting encounters and obstacles mid-travel, even though some of these can be very thematically appropriate to the genre, you need to consider the risk that a bad dice roll or a poor tactical decision might cause. It might lead to a big change that your players and you might not especially want to actually play through.
Yeah, I mean, if you as a GM set this up and don't consider the consequences of what might happen, you could end up putting the players and yourself somewhere that you just don't want to be and isn't fun. But like that time when we played Zelda Wind Waker and George got annoyed at having to play a prison break scenario when you had been looking forward to just sailing around and fighting sea monsters smashing pots and all the
Zelda-ing. Things. Yeah, there was this period in the mid-2000s where every game decided, I know what I'll do. I'll put a stealth section in. Does our game have stealth sections?
No.
Like, Zelda was right at the start. It wasn't even like I was halfway through the game. I just got my sword. Now what? Now we're taking your sword away from you because swords are bad.
You're having to pretend to be Solid Snake.
Oh.
Anyway, moving swiftly on.
But yeah, look, you need to consider if you need to set up, you know, the situation with that in mind. If you maybe need to put in some get out of jail cards. If you need to lessen the nature of the initial conflict whatever. There's no point in, because of sheer luck, you end up killing off half the group and everyone has to roll new characters because turns out Runder the Uncanny isn't that uncanny a captain after all, and he's run us aground on a coral reef 500 miles away from anywhere.
Another thing to think about is sometimes your characters will own their own vehicle, or the game will be set on the same vehicle like Starship Enterprise. Even if you're only hiring this vehicle for a single journey, they will still need to visit transport hubs.
I suspect very few of you here listening to this podcast own an airplane, but you've probably been to an airport at least once. Although if you are rich enough to own an airplane, have you considered donating to our Ko-fi? Link in the show description.
There's lots of inspiration you can take here from Star Trek Deep Space Nine or Babylon 5. These giant transport hubs become their own little worlds and microcosms. They've got their own squabbles, factions, internal politics. There's, of course, that constant stream of different alien species coming in and out every day. But there are also residents who have set up a permanent home there.
Yeah, even in a more fantasy or modern setting, a port city, a pirate island, an airport would have a lot of the same elements in play. And we've seen a few airports in the last week.
Yeah, we've been to airports in multiple continents, and they do all sort of look and feel the same in many respects. It's a bit weird, and they're all a bit like Vegas. You've got no idea what time it is once you're in one. There's lots of expensive things to buy, and inexplicably, there's an arcade in the corner.
I do remember it was about 5 in the morning in Dubai Airport eating a muffin at Starbucks. Like, could be anything.
I mean, at least there you've got the call to prayer to differentiate you, but you
wasn't expecting the call to prayer at 5 in the morning. That was a bit of a surprise over the tannoy. But yeah, look, the thing about airports and that sort of thing, spaceports, whatever, they're not exactly set up for local citizens. They're set up for the traveller, which is a very different thing. The signage has to be understandable to travellers, not just natives. So it's not necessarily the native tongue of the country or the planet or the sector you're in. In a D&D style fantasy game, your elves might have to grudgingly dual sign everything at the naval city in common, because none of the others can pronounce baggage collection point in its elven form.
How you sort out the toilet arrangements in your sci-fi airport are up to you, of course. I mean, remember the separate bathrooms per Pac Mara in Babylon 5?
Oh yeah, they're carrion eaters, so I think that's...
It's probably best not to think too hard.
And, you know, look, at a fantasy setting, maybe your, you know, D&D style group sees the halfling stag party coming to the bathroom and you go, you know what, I'll leave it. I'll wait till the next service station.
Expanding out on this, airports themselves are liminal spaces, so these spaces that exist between one destination and the next. Simultaneously, they are their own unique contained space. And yet, they're sort of nowhere and somehow all the same. There's a lot of ways that you can use that element of weirdness to your advantage when you're building stories and plot hooks for your players to investigate. For example, the laws inside an airport might not exactly match those of the countries that it's sat in. For example, duty-free shopping.
Right. Perhaps certain controlled substances aren't legal inside or outside the airport, but, you know, are the other way around. Perhaps licensing laws don't apply the same way. Like, pubs in Britain can only be open certain periods of time, but you go into an airport 24 hours a day, there will be a pub open, because British people will insist on a pint before going in a plane, no matter the time. If a fugitive legs it inside an airport, are they technically still in the country? Can they be arrested by the normal police?
I mean, mind that time when Edward Snowden got stuck in an airport for over a month after the US took his passport off him. Or, I mean, Tom Hanks made a whole film called The Terminal where a guy lived in an airport for several years because he was exiled from his own country.
Yeah, I mean, again, the shops inside, again, your typical airport, you can buy all the sunglasses and magazines you want. But you're not going to find, like, a greengrocer's. You certainly won't find an armory, but even really pro-gun US states like Florida. I assure you, Orlando International Airport does not have a Smith & Wesson shop where you can stock up before flying. Your players may not be easily able to stock up on certain essentials or adventurer essentials, so might have to get creative if all they've got available to them is what's in the Dwarven port or what's in Mesopotamia 8, the space station.
If you're really wanting to push that liminal space aspect and the concept of a transport hub as an in-between place, perhaps it could also be somewhere that characters can, either accidentally or on purpose, travel between realities or between timelines. If you've ever watched the second series of the Netflix show Russian Doll, which is excellent by the way, you should, the character Nadia takes New York subway and randomly finds herself travel back in time and body swapped with her own mother. And the character Alan ends up visiting his own family's past in 60s East Germany. Eventually, through convoluted plot, they end up in the bowels of this underground system. It's kind of like the Jeffrey's tube through time.
That's a metaphor.
Trying to get back to their own reality. I mean, imagine if Bill and Ted stepped outside of the phone box while they were mid-journey. What would happen?
In our superhero game, we had a session where you guys went exploring the kind of space between parallel universes. I think you met these like super advanced aliens who gave you this really long, complex, boring explanation about how hypertime worked. And one of the players just went, warp zone. It's like the warp zone from Mario Brothers. Got it, whatever. And so for the rest of the adventure, we just talked about exploring the warp zone.
That made sense to us.
Yeah.
If you've ever read the Narnia novels, specifically the first one, The Magician's Nephew, which I will go out on a limb and say I enjoyed better than The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Yes, The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe is the first published, but The Magician's Nephew is the first chronologically. And I would agree with you, it's very good and doesn't get enough of a rep.
In that novel, there's this place called the Wood Between the Worlds.
Oh yeah, it's like a wood with like little magical pools, right? There are also portals.
Yeah, so you can dive in to access the new worlds. And of course, shenanigans ensue when the White Witch escapes from her own pool and goes on a rampage through 1900s London.
See, if they'd given us that as a film rather than like Dawn Treader, maybe we'd have done better.
Another thing that's scope for is to have one starting point but two different destinations. In Harry Potter, for example, even the Muggles can access platforms 9 and 10 in King's Cross Station, but only the magic users know how to run through the wall into platform 9 and 3 quarters, which opens up a completely different travel route.
Is there something about problematic female authors? Because the other example I've got is also a problematic female fantasy author. Marion Zimmer Bradley wrote Mists of Avalon, Arthurian fantasy, but from a feminist angle book. In that, the Isle of Avalon is two different physical locations, one a Christian convent, the other a pagan druidic school for the ladies of the lake. But they kind of like overlap. It's like there's two islands, but depending on your magical incantations and the way you're crossing and who you're crossing with, you cross the lake to the island. You will arrive at one of the two islands, not necessarily the one you're trying to get to.
Yeah, and of course there is one bit of the novel where young Guinevere accidentally falls through reality and ends up on the other island.
Yes, and that's the thing that I did actually incorporate in our Pendragon role-playing game, because I really like that idea of Guinevere, who, let's be honest, otherwise has no personality apart from I don't have babies and I fancy Lancelot. But you don't need to get into these liminal spaces that Ailsa was talking about with the law to be strange. Just being on a boat has its own legal complications.
I mean, that could be pleasant things, like on a starship, the captain is able to administer the weddings of their crew. Captain Kirk does it, for example. But there's more sinister situations that player characters, let's face it, tend to get involved in,
yeah,
that might have less pleasant implications. The boat may abide by the legal system of the country or planet it is registered to, not necessarily where the majority of its passengers or crew is from.
So, for example, we are on a Disney cruise. Disney is an American company. Most of the passengers are American. The crew are a bit of a mixed bag, but with a notable amount of Americans as well, yes? So naturally, the Disney Fantasy is registered in Bermuda.
Which is totally a tax dodge.
It also affects things like, you know, gambling law, alcohol law, employment law, all these things. This ship is effectively Bermuda for those purposes, which, if something were to happen, might have legal implications. If the Mailer Demon gets fed up of listening to this rant from his bathroom, and he comes through and he murders me with his flensing knife, Bermuda law, not American law, not British law, would apply. If your countries and planets do or don't have treaties with each other, if they do or don't have cordial relations, this situation might get more complex if certain people will or won't extradite or try certain crimes.
I mean, you could even go super old school, depending on what your setting is, and have it that the captain's word on the boat, or their whim, was the law. Your players might find themselves keel-hauled if they overstep their boundaries.
He's going to find himself keel-hauled if he doesn't keep his volume down a bit.
Oh, sorry, Mailer Demon. Do you want some Tums?
Let's give him some space.
Maybe we need to open a window. It's getting a bit...
There's a quiz going on in one of the pubs we could go to. It's about Michael Eisner and his time in the company.
Oh, I could probably help with that. I know Michael.
You know Michael Eisner?
Yes. He was my roommate in college. He still has my copy of the Da Vinci Code, now that I think about it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Coming soon to the Till Dice Network, more celebrity chit-chat with me, Tubby Juniper Smythe. Yes, that's right. Once again, you can join me in my luxurious bedroom, sitting on the 4-poster bed with brand new pillows that my good friend Demi Lovato made for me. You know, they took up crafting recently and they've got absolutely amazing at it. Plus, they've got a lovely eye for colour. Anyway, back on topic. Here in my boudoir, we'll be chatting to a range of guests. And this run is going to start with Barovian royalty, with Count Strad von Zarovich.
I am the ancient. I am the land.
I am very glad to be joining you here today.
There's so many questions I know you'll want to ask. Where does he get those amazing red silk accessories?
You know, Lord Soth and I have much bad blood between us, but I cannot tell a lie. The dyes in his domain are magnificent.
Has he finally moved on from his awkward relationship history?
I feel so sorry now for how I have treated Irina, most inappropriate. I suppose I was trying too hard to compensate. I have learned a new term to describe me. I believe in your land it is called closeted.
And his fascinating recent charity work for the Vistani people and the attention he's been drawing to the terrible persecution they suffer.
Listen to them, the children of the night. What outdated Victorian stereotypes of traveller and Roma people they make. It's 2022, people. Honestly, I expect better. And I'm lawful evil.
So be sure to subscribe to In Bed with Tuppy, the only show that gets everyone's favourite Dark Lords in for a chat. It's even more fun than that time Blake Lively and I hacked Leonardo DiCaprio's Tinder account and set it to only look for people aged 35 or over. Oh, you should have seen the look on his little face when he thought he could only date people a mere 10 years younger than him.
See me. See me now.
Yes, you're right there, darling. Very good. This segment comes with a content warning for suicide, human remains, and child endangerment. Hello, listeners. You join us here on holiday in Florida, in the happiest place on earth. We're in Walt Disney's Epcot, or as Twike insists on calling it, Disneyland for Nerds.
Now, I'd like to tell you that we're strolling around in the sun, eating a handwich, browsing through the shops in the World Showcase. In fact, I am stuck on Spaceship Earth.
Yeah, you know that one that looks like a big golf ball?
That one.
It's a geodesic dome, but it's a golf ball. It's a golf ball. Yeah. The whole ride broke down like 15 minutes ago, and we've been stuck here in the dark with a bunch of glitching 1980s animatronics, which is definitely not nightmare fuel.
It's proper nightmare. Twink is down to last packet of Twinkies.
I really hope we can get out of here soon. Oh, I know, George, you were really wanting to go on Journey into Imagination.
Oh, yeah, with Figment. That was one of my favourite rides as a kid.
Speaking of, imagination. Yeah, you see what I did there? See what I did?
Yeah.
While we're stuck sitting here, I thought we might as well tell you all about a role-playing game that is rather thematic to where we are, in fact, sitting right now.
Oh, I see. You're wanting to talk about Happiest Apocalypse on Earth.
That's right. So Happiest Apocalypse on Earth is written by a chap called Christopher Gray. So you can find him at his website, christopher.world. Now, he's written multiple RPGs, including Temples and Tombs, which is published by Gallant Knight Games. That's for creating fast-paced, pulpy adventures like Indiana Jones, The Mummy, Romancing the Stone.
I think he's also got quite a few credits out of 5th Ed D&D adventures and stuff on DM's Guild.
Yeah, he's also got a new game coming soon called Highcaster. So that's a game about creating legends. He also, and this is quite cool, does Kickstarter coaching. So if you pitch him a game that you're working on, he'll lend you his skills as a real-life marketing and communications professional.
Oh.
And also just, you know, being generally a gaming enthusiast with lots of experience of getting his own Kickstarters funded to help get your game off the ground, which is pretty cool.
That's quite smart. Now, The Happiest Apocalypse on Earth was nominated for Emmys in 2018. It was nominated for Product of the Year and also nominated for Best Interior Art, with Robert Hebert doing the bulk of the art.
You can buy it on DriveThruRPG for pay-as-you-want, but the suggested price for softcover black and white book is $14.95. I'll put up a link on our social medias. This is a game for a group of people, it suggests, between 2 and 5, so we could in fact play it as we're sitting here right now.
So, the concept here, the simple description of this game would be Mickey Mouse meets Cthulhu. Or, to use a description that reflects our current situation, Five Nights at Freddy's set at Epcot.
I do not like Five Nights at Freddy's one bit.
No.
It is just... Oh, God, I genuinely have got a major fear of dolls and animatronics.
You've mentioned in the podcast before, in fact.
Yes, so I'm not going to lie, I am... Oh, yeah, I don't like enclosed spaces either.
That's why we're doing this, to keep you distracted.
Yeah.
But look, it's not Five Nights at Freddy. We're in Disney. This is America. I mean, nobody's going to get killed by an animatronic. They get sued. Anyway, the author's blurb basically says he was playing another RPG with his kid, who's been raised on things like Five Nights at Freddy's, like creepypastas. And the child's suggestion was, let's do a game in a theme park run by an eldritch abomination. I don't know if the kid could pronounce eldritch or abomination right, but it's a good idea.
So the default setting in this game is Mouse Park. Obviously not copyrighted at all,
no.
Which is built in Southern California at the autumn equinox of 1955.
Completely coincidentally, the same place and year that certain Mr. Walt E. Disney opened his first theme park. So yeah, the Mouse Park is opened by Elias Roy. He's a Hollywood mogul who was famous for Mr. Mouse and Pals cartoons. But then it all started to go wrong, in particularly when in 1965, in front of paying guests, Elias Roy climbed to the top of Princess Castle and threw himself off.
Ever since that day, there's been all manner of strange crimes, strange incidents and rumours of cover-ups by lots of lawsuits and mouse money. So into this weirdness, your player characters will step, all determined to have the happiest holiday of a lifetime, no matter the cost.
Do you reckon we'll get any compensation when we get out of here? I mean, I'll settle for like a money off churros voucher. But yeah, you don't have to play guests. Some or all of your group can be mouseineers, whether that's teenagers doing a summer job or older hands who have already seen some weird stuff in their years of service.
So we have played this game, and in our game we had a mixture of guests and staff. So that gave us a mixture of perspectives and skills. But you can just focus on one group if you want to.
If you've got experience with horror games, I'm sure you can easily imagine how you could do a one-off in this setting. The satirical elements of the game easily lend themselves to a more comedic tone. If you think, like, you know, the episode of The Simpsons where they visit Itchy and Scratchy Land and it goes a bit Westworld. But you can also focus on the horror, on the terror aspects of that.
Yeah, I mean, you can take it either way. Your players might want to protect their characters by running away from the terrible eldritch horrors lurking beneath this pastel pink playground. Or perhaps they might wish to join forces with them in their hellish crusade and perpetuate their evil reign. I mean, nothing could possibly go wrong with that.
I mean, it might be you want something less overtly mouse parody. And there's options for that. There's rules and guidance for making your own theme park setting. But, I mean, in the world of theme parks, there's a clear top dog or top
mouse.
Yeah. Even people that haven't visited Disney World probably still recognise it's a small world. But look, if you want to do a game about Yogg-Sothoth lurking underneath Alton Towers, if you want Six Flags over Nyarnflut, that one, be my guest.
I thought you mean be our guest. So, if you want to play this game, you will need a pile of D6s, at least two, preferably two per player. All the dice rolls in this game are 2d6 based.
Yeah.
We'll get into that later. You'll need some character sheets. The PDF copy of the rules comes with all the various documents that you need to print off. They are in modular format. Again, we'll get to that. You'll need the usual papers, pencils, and probably a printer or photocopier and some glue. Again, all will be explained. Mouse ears and churros are optional, but they can enhance the experience.
As would pin badges. Speaking of which, is this going to get moving anytime soon? Because I've got like a pin trading event I want to go to. I mean, I think it's working because that animatronic wasn't facing us 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
It's probably powering back up again. Okay, system-wise. In episodes 1 and 9 respectively, we have reviewed Night Witches and The Warren, which are powered by the Apocalypse games. This is also a powered by the Apocalypse game. So the core engine under the hood is very similar. You have core stats in this game that are called Brave, Stout, Sweet, Wicked and Wise. And they're rated between +2 and -1. You also have a PAL score with your other players to reflect how close you are with them. Those can be positive or negative numbers if you're very friendly or very opposed to them.
So, as mentioned, to do anything, you need to roll 2d6 and add some small bonuses. You will succeed on a 10 or more, you will fail on a 6 or less. If you roll a 7 to 9, then that's a maybe or conditional success. So, for example, if you are trying to intimidate someone into giving you a discount because it's your child's birthday, then on a 7+, the target would be intimidated and give you a 10% discount, but you're now in their bad books. If you get a 10+, the target might actually suffer actual mental damage from your threats to speak to their manager, or they might be forced to run away after giving you what you want. If you roll a 6 or less, your target is completely unfazed by the threats, and you may find a security guard dressed as a rabbit escorting you off the premises.
Oh, you don't want to go in the briar patch. Am I allowed to make briar patch jokes? Maybe don't bring it up too much while we're here. Look, combat is not mega detailed. It just works off a variant of this system. Damage is tracked on harm for physical or shock for mental.
I mean, it seems a bit arbitrary though. I mean, how could you possibly take damage at a theme park other than vomiting on the roller coaster? Lol.
I mean, right now, getting a dead leg from sitting down is my main damage. But look, you're not tracking huge amounts of damage. 3 harm points is enough to effectively kill your character. 3 shock points is enough to leave them mentally unable to function. So characters shouldn't be getting into a running punching battle with Goofy here.
So you can't always negate any shock or harm suffered. You can't even re-roll dice by using the special move Wish Upon a Star. If you wish upon a star, that requires no dice roll, but it does earn you 1 twinkle point as the weird beings of the theme park start to notice you. When you reach 3 twinkles, a horrible doom befalls you. inflicting a lasting injury or trauma to your character. How lovely.
Now, the title of that move might sound familiar. A lot of the moves in this game have names inspired by a certain very litigious media corporation with a theme park section. The searching move, for example, is called Find Something There That Wasn't There Before. The enduring resisting move is called Go the Distance.
And the advancement to fight better when you fight angry is called Let It Go.
If you have children listening, I apologise they started singing. Also, why do you have children listening to our podcast? This is not for children. Children have never seen Space Above and Beyond. Unlike other Powered by the Apocalypse games, character generation is a bit more modular here. Rather than just having lots of separate playbooks for each individual character, there's multiple segments that you combine.
So all the characters mechanically consist of three different elements. So there's their status, they're either a guest or a mousineer. There's their personality type, which are based on the four humours of ancient Greek thinking. So that's sanguine, choleric, melancholic or phlegmatic.
Never say this podcast doesn't teach you anything.
And finally, the nature of employment. So are they unemployed, service industry, blue collar, professional, etc.
Each choice gives you access to some different moves above and beyond the basic ones. At character generation, you only have one move from each of the categories, but through play, you can earn more. So you might, for example, start off with a melancholic move, a mousineer move, and a service industry move.
So the PDF does come with all of these elements in a format that lets you print out a template character sheet and actually cut out and stick on the additional modular elements as you choose them. So you sort of get this Frankenstein character sheet at the end.
We should probably put some pictures up on the socials because it's kind of hard to describe visually.
Yeah. Oh, actually, George, I think they're starting to empty out the ride. We should get moving soon.
Really?
Yeah, like in the cart behind us.
Yeah, it's called an Omni Mover at Disney parlance, darling.
Yes, thank you. Oh, it's empty. I mean, they must have left in a hurry, mind. Someone's dropped their handbag. Oh, I'll hand that in when we get out.
Anyway, as you mentioned, we've played this game before.
We did indeed, and I played the magnificent Karen Vanderhoffen. So I was playing the ultimate Karen, the kind of nightmare woman that every millennial hates encountering in a work environment. She was a Mouseland super fan. You know, one of those slightly creepy, cult-like adults who base their entire personality on a super twee fandom.
I'm just off 1 week on a Disney cruise. Yes, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. So my character had, unsurprisingly, a Karen haircut, a sense of supreme entitlement, and an unshakable belief that the customer is always right. She was on the hunt for pin badges to complete her collection and was dragging along her long-suffering husband, Brad, who was played by another member of our group. Very much think Hyacinth Bouquet and Richard from Keeping Up Appearances.
So our adventure saw us visit Pirate's Landing, a completely non-copyrighted animatronic boat ride that just happens to pass through some pirates who just so happen to exist in the Caribbean.
Flawless, darling.
The Mouseineer players came to get the riders out when it broke down and escort them out. It would be nice if people did that for us right now, mate, rather than me just sitting here talking into a microphone in the dark. But then it became apparent that the pirate animatronics had ideas of their own.
So I should say at this point, this game idea played off some real world myths and legends about the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, which you might have heard. There is a whole wealth of inspiration out there online on real-life Disney conspiracies and genuine weirdness. If you're interested in that, I would recommend checking out YouTuber Disney Dan or Defunctland.
I mean, for example, it did happen in 1967 that the design team thought the 60s fake skeletons available to them weren't very convincing. So they just went back to their old alma mater of UCLA and said, hey, you know how the human remains that you use in the medical department? Have you got any old skeleton ones that you're not using that we can borrow for a bit?
Yeah, so being the 60s, there wasn't any ethical or legal concerns around human remains. They just went, yeah, sure. And a bunch of honest-to-God skeletons ended up on a ride that's for entertaining children. Now, you'll all be pleased to know that that is no longer the case. They have been properly buried and replaced by
modern animatronics.
Yes, now they're replaced by things that are far more disturbing, such as animatronics of Johnny Depp.
Oh, careful there, George.
Another story about Pirates of the Caribbean, though, and one that's more central to our game, and one that I'm really fond of, is the Perpetual Chess Game.
And again, you can look this up. We'll stick up some links to social media on these real-life stories. This story goes that the Imagineer Mark Davis designed the rides so that two of the skeleton pirates were sitting at a chessboard looking at an impossible game. That is, no matter who moves next, it's going to be a stalemate.
So actually there's a chess word for this, something you might be familiar with, zugzwang, which is when it's your turn, you have to move, but any move you make makes your position worse.
I mean, any move we made right now could only be better.
Mm, true. But yeah, the idea was Pirates Landing had its chessboard banged and changed by an angry staff member. The positions were altered. The spirits of the ride got angry. And the guests found themselves poor, unfortunate souls.
Oh!
Yeah, yeah.
So when weirdness started to happen in our game, our characters had to then run the gauntlet through the ride's set pieces towards the emergency exit. My character, Karen, was convinced that this was merely a mechanical failure caused by her husband Brad's flash photography and complained every step of the way. The two Mouseineers had a better understanding of the severity of the problem. Apparently, they'd just been told by management that the emergency protocols at times like this were to seal the ride up and just let the things work out their system.
I believe in the end, Karen was the last one to make it to the emergency exit when she got caught by a pirate. And Brad's at the door just looked at you, reconsidered his life choices, and quietly shut and locked the door in your face.
I mean, I would have done the same, really. But yes, George knowingly played off one of my genuine real-life fears, as mentioned. I am terrified. I am terrified of dolls, mannequins, animatronics, anything plastic or metal that is human-shaped and have been since I was a wee girl. So in this game, when the lights went down and the pirate suddenly turned round to look at me and spoke, I actually started to have palpitations in real life. So yes, thank you, George. Thank you for that.
That's long-term relationships for you.
Speaking of which, I really hope we get out of here soon.
Okay, focus. Positives. Let's talk about positives for the game. Well, as mentioned, most people have some understanding of the tropes at play here. Even if you have not personally visited a major American theme park, you've probably been to like a carnival ride or visited a haunted house. Things like Family Guy and The Simpsons and South Park have parodied Disney, so people kind of understand the elements in play.
I mean, even if you've never been to a theme park, I'm sure we've all been on a family day out somewhere where everyone's pretending to have a good time but secretly wishing they were anywhere else.
Also, as a positive, this idea is relatively flexible to time period or location.
Yeah, so if you're wanting to visit Mouse Park Paris, or you want to set your game in the 90s where everything's all neon and gnarly, as an easy change which doesn't affect the core of the game. You could even make up your own theme park, like Nessie World in Scotland. That could be an interesting setting. Or if you have got a local theme park, past or present, where you live, you could create a horror version of it.
So like in the north of Scotland, Aberdeen has Storybook Glen, which is basically a bunch of like dioramas of like nursery rhymes. I visited there once as a child and it had clearly seen better days and was already quite terrifying even before we like add in some Cthulhu elements. And there are multiple abandoned crinkly bottom theme parks, which means that the Cthulhoid horror could be Mr. Blobby, a piece of British 90s weirdness that we mentioned before back in episode 25.
Yeah, have fun Googling that, American listeners. I mean, you could even go all out and make your setting Banksy's Dismaland, complete with Crashed Pumpkin Coach. If you're not familiar, I'll stick up a link. It was something else.
Yeah, but yeah, like all Power of the Apocalypse games, the core engine is really straightforward. It's 2d6 plus a couple of small numbers. You don't need to buy fancy dice. You don't need to do complex mathematics. The game just gets moving quickly.
I mean, one thing that I really, really like about this game, the interior art of this book is really, really fantastic. I mean, it was nominated for an Emmy, after all. A lot of it has got this sort of golden age, 1930s-esque cartoon feel, but gone horribly wrong. Oh yeah, and then there's the suspicious looking blood spatters bordering every page and occasional use of creepy fonts. It just ramps up that horror vibe.
Yeah, it's black and white throughout, but it's good. Again, the book is just really easy to read. It's very clearly laid out. There's a good contents page. The borders and the fonts don't get in the way of reading it. It's just some role-playing game books can be pretty but busy. This is still practical.
Yeah. Other positive, the PDF is pay what you want, so you can just check it out easily rather than having to make a big investment. I actually bought George the fancy hard copy version for Christmas a couple of years ago, which is a nice little A5 sized book.
And look, despite the fact that I was playing off your genuine terror of your worst fear coming to life, you still had a lot of fun, right? I mean, there's you know, this kind of urgency and suspense from the horror. And the game system helps play up the idea that you're fragile and that, you know, you're kind of very much having to stay focused and stay tense.
Yeah, and like Karen, not all your characters are going to make it out the end.
No.
I mean, one of this game's biggest strengths is possibly also a weakness. Because the premise is so accessible and the system is so easy to pick up, anyone can play it. So grannies and children will all be able to get on board with the theme. But the horror element of it may genuinely not be suitable for everyone. So as mentioned, this is a game where genuinely unpleasant things can and do happen, including to children. So for that reason alone, some people just might wish to nope out of it,
yeah.
Which is fine. For the right people, this could easily be someone's first game, but depending on their temperament, it might also end up being their last game if they end up completely traumatised.
On more explicit negatives, the modular assembly idea for the character sheets is a cute idea, but it is a real faff to do. If you're printing stuff out, you're going to have to print out a bunch of sheets, physically cut out segments of them, give people like some Pritt stick or paperclip, something to assemble your character sheet in front of you in a way that won't fall apart halfway through the game.
It's not the most environmentally friendly game in that regard.
And it's even tougher, I would argue, if you're playing remotely, as we were when we were trying to do it. You can't just send a list of playbooks and say, pick one and, you know, print two pages. Players will either have to have multiple PDF windows open and flick between them, or they're going to have to, like, screenshot and cut and paste and Frankenstein together a sheet for themselves. This is the kind of faff you don't usually have to worry about in a role-playing game of this mechanical simplicity.
I mean, it's not an insurmountable issue, but it is a complication and something to bear in mind,
Especially
if you don't have a printer. Like a lot of horror games with high player mortality, like Dread, this is not an easy game to imagine a campaign for. I mean, perhaps if you were all playing Mouseineers with the understanding that a new weirdness would take place every week and it was your job to go in and clean it up, that would give you a reason to keep going back to this place of unspeakable horrors. But the premise just lends itself better to one-offs and shorter games.
Yeah, I could see it as being good as like a palate cleanser between campaigns, but if you're the kind of person that likes complex character development and months-long epic adventures, I don't think it's really going to suit you. Also, people who might not like it are people who think that the Disney theme names are cute but not actually very useful. I can't just look up the fight move or the search move.
And for example, one of the sanguine moves is hold your banner high. Now that's about inspiring people with rallying words or song. Now that's obviously a reference to the Mickey Mouse Club song, but at a quick glance it might not be immediately obvious in the heat of play when you're trying to search for it.
And again, not everyone's seen every Disney film and knows every song or supposedly iconic line.
I mean, sure, tell the tale as old as time and let your conscience be your guide. You might think those are classic lines and you assume everyone knows it, but there's plenty more in the book that neither of us recognised and we had to Google.
I mean, look, Disney's a huge property that spills out to pop culture. It has some of the best known quotes and songs out there. But yeah, you and I were looking at a couple of these going, what is this from?
Yeah, like the move to make an over-the-top threat is show how snake-like you can be, which we both initially thought was Ka from the Jungle Book.
But he doesn't have a song. So,
yeah. Turns out it's something Jafar says in Aladdin when he steals the genie's powers.
And I had Aladdin on VHS and I have zero recollection of this line.
I went to see it at the cinema for my birthday. But yeah, you can understand what the move does from the description. I would assume the word snake implied some sort of sneaky move. And I don't know, I might struggle to find it or use it properly in the heat of the moment.
It's not a deal breaker, but I can see how it could jam a game up if you can't simply point to the sneak move and know where it is, but have to remember, like, which particular Disney film is referenced. I mean, from my perspective running it, Powered by the Apocalypse games are quite straightforward to run as a GM. They're quite mechanically light. Crucially, I don't have to roll any dice. All the checks are done by the players themselves.
So, George the GM wouldn't roll for a pirate to hit Karen with his cutlass. I would be rolling for my character to avoid being hit by said cutlass.
Right, player facing. GM is kind of refereeing the game. They give you ideas and concepts, but they don't have to worry as much about numbers. There aren't stat blocks for NPCs or monsters to get bogged down in, so you can kind of focus on your task at hand. And again, the book does come with several pre-made adventures ready to roll, so you can just pick up this PDF or book and be going quite quickly.
So the game that we played was actually a modified version of one of these pre-made adventures. George just added in the little chessboard factoid because it was something that he had genuinely found interesting in real life.
Again, when I was younger, we visited Disney World in Florida quite a lot. My parents enjoyed visiting Florida. So I found it very easy to be inspired to make a schmaltzy yet terrifying theme park. Also, there's a certain charm in taking a sort of mega media friendly character like Bugs Bunny or Mickey Mouse or Super Mario and sort of reimagining them as the friendly face of a Cthulhuid horror.
Oh my god, can you imagine Mario Land in Osaka? That would be a great setting for this game.
Oh my god, Bowser the Cthulhuid horror.
It would have that same sort of clash between cuddly and terrifying. You know, the same sort of thing that gave us games like Pokethulu or those bloomin' horrifying Fuggler dolls with teeth. I mean, as if you couldn't make dolls worse. I mean, seriously, kids are weird.
But yeah, there's no shortage of media about theme parks, and in particular Disney parks online. You mentioned Disney Dan and Defunctland. There are other YouTube channels that I follow who have quality content that you could get some inspiration from.
Yep, I'm sure Twike will have lots of fun posting some of those up once we get going.
Oh! It's the lights coming back up! We'll be out of here in no time. Oh. Ride's still broken, the wheel, so that should be tomorrow's child playing at this part, but it sounds a bit more, you know,
Satan-y?
I wasn't going to say Satan-y in Disney, Elsa. Maybe Chernabog from Fantasia.
George? I think that's worse. Okay, that's the end of another episode. Thanks so much.
Elsa, it's not.
Wait, what?
It's not the end of the episode.
Why not?
Well, you know how last time we did a Christmas special, we had like a
bonus... Are we going to do another Christmas quiz?
We had a bonus Christmas quiz.
Yes!
So in episode 25, we had a quiz all about Christmas number ones. So songs that got to the top of the British charts for music on Christmas, which in Britain is a big deal.
It's not quite as big as it used to be, but when we were wee, it really was.
Well, I have got a quiz about Christmas number twos. No giggling. Because of course, to quote a very Christmassy film, they can't all be winners, can they?
Ah, true.
And so some quite big songs only got as far as Christmas number two. Some slightly weird songs got to number two. They are not all Christmas songs, as with the Christmas number one's position. These are just songs that were in the charts. Sometimes they're Christmassy, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're not, but we put a sleigh bell on them and we hope that's good enough. Yeah, I'm calling you out, E17.
Needs more sleigh bell.
So I have got 10 songs. What's going to happen is I'm going to read you a lyric from this song. And I want you to tell me the performer and the song title.
Okay, okay.
And all you're going to know is that it was a Christmas number two. I can offer you the year it was made it
okay,
to number,
okay.
Not, made it to number two. Not always the same as year it got released.
Okay, so I'll get points for this. What if we do like Christmas themed points? What if I get, I don't know, like, not candy canes, that's too American. What's
mince pies.
A mince pie!
Okay, you get a half a mince pie for getting the artist right, a half a mince pie for getting the song title right. So there's 10 right. mince pies
oh,
up for grabs.
There's 10 mince pies on the line, everybody.
Okay, so I've got one of my Q Workshop Christmas dice here to help us keep track of the score. And let's start off with number one. They sold me a dream of Christmas. They sold me a silent night. They sold me a dream of Christmas. They sold me a silent night.
Now, that's Greg Lake, isn't it? Is that one that, you know, it's a bit grim at the end.
It's
you know,
very
like,
grim.
You know, Merry Christmas, Noel, be it heaven or hell, the Christmas we get, we deserve.
That's the one.
Which I feel just becomes more and more relevant with every passing year.
So you're right, it's Greg Lake of later Emerson, Lake and Palmer fame, but I'm going to need a song title.
My brain keeps saying Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time, and it's not that.
No, that's Wings.
I should say... George and I are both utterly stuffed up with the cold right now. If we cough into the mic, I really apologise. But I feel like my brain is mush right now. That probably wasn't the best time to do a quiz.
Well, now we're going to have to pass?
No, I'm not
Sorry,
getting stuck on the first question.
Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, this might be like a 20-minute long quiz section.
This is like American McGee's Alice all over again, where I couldn't get out the tutorial section. I need to just play it in my head. Simply.
No, that's the wrong one!
No!
They sold me a dream of Christmas. They sold me
a
silent
night.
That's the one.
With Needs More Sleigh Bile. No, it's out of my head. Can't mind.
I Believe in Father Christmas.
Oh, yeah. You know, I couldn't make it out the tutorial in one of the Tomb Raider games either, and I went in such a huff.
You did. Number two. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as in heaven. 1999.
Oh, this is bloomin' Cliff bloomin' Richard.
It'd be very difficult for our non-British listeners to explain who Cliff Richard is. I will try. He was a 1950s knockoff Elvis for Britain who never went away and has had several Christmas number ones and, in this case, a Christmas number two.
And he now thinks he owns Christmas because he did a really terrible rendition of The Lord's Prayer.
He did.
And tried to release it as a single.
But what did he call this terrible rendition of The Lord's Prayer that he released in 1999?
It wasn't just called The Lord's Prayer?
No.
Oh, I don't know. A Christmas Prayer.
1999 was a clue. The Millennium Prayer. It was the words of the Lord's Prayer set to the tune of Auld Lang Syne. If you're thinking that sounds terrible.
It was.
Yeah. Okay, I've got better hope for number three for getting you a full mince pie. Number three. You went away upon Boxing Day. Now how the hell am I going to make it into the new year? 2003. This is not an obscure song. This is not me, like, raiding the archives.
No, we listened to this when we're having lunch today. Ah, we went out for pancakes today, and this was playing.
Yes.
Because it's The Darkness.
Yes.
A song that was entirely made so that Justin Hawking could say a rude word on the radio. And we're looking at you, Justin. We know you did it. We know that you just wanted to say bell end on the radio. Don't let the bells end.
I'll let you have that. Christmas time, open brackets, Don't Let the Bells End by The Darkness, 2003.
I get a full mince pie.
You get a full mince pie.
Yes.
You're on two mince pies now overall.
I mean, I assume these mince pies are in the cupboard somewhere. Because it would have been so much better if they'd been lined up and I could have then had to continue the episode while eating them.
I think it'd be funnier if they weren't gluten-free mince pies and this was like a weird murder mystery story. This would be the Columbo episode where I bump you off. Number four. Now, I should say, number one and number four are the only ones that were before you and I were born. But there were songs that were big enough that I didn't feel they were bad. Okay? It's not like Rock Around the Clock, for example, was a number two over Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
I've not gone that far. I've only gone 1972. Very Christmassy song, ladies and gentlemen. When Mama took me to Sunday school, they tried to teach me the golden rule. Every time the choir would sing. And if I finished this lyric, I would say the name of the song and you would get it.
The only thing I can think that's going to rhyme with this, and George has got a little smirk on his face, which means he thinks he's been really, really clever and a little bit rude. I think this is My Ding-a-ling.
Uh-huh, and who do you think performed My Ding-a-ling?
Milhouse from The Simpsons.
That's that's really all you could offer us.
They did.
Okay, I don't think he had a number two in it though in 1972.
Oh, my brain's saying Chuck Berry. It wasn't Chuck Berry.
Do you want to go with Chuck Berry?
Oh, that's all I got.
It's Chuck Berry!
Is it? Yes. Okay, I thought he was too cool for that.
Oh. So, My Ding-a-ling is a song all about somebody that got a toy that was covered in sleigh bells.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. And he talks about how every time the choir would sing, I would play with my ding-a-ling.
So he's playing with multiple bell-ends.
This song, when it was played on Top of the Pops, famous British censorious old woman Mary Whitehouse complained that it should only be played with footage of Chuck Berry actually playing with a bell to make it clear that he was playing with a ding-a-ling and not his penis. Mary Whitehouse is another character in the British lexicon who would be quite difficult to explain.
It's just the fun police. Imagine, Thingy Bush, what's her name?
Barbara Bush. Or Tipper Gore. But it's but unlike in America, where it was people who were really big and important, she was some random woman who just decided one day, I think I'll ruin television for everyone. Anyway, she's dead, so who's laughing now?
George.
Oh, I'm sorry. Should I give Christmas goodwill to Mary Whitehouse?
No, I don't think she really deserved it. She was a busybody.
Number five. Preheat the oven to 350 and give that spoon a lick. 1990.
Oh, that's Chocolate Salty Balls. That's Chef from South Park.
That is Chef from South Park. With Chocolate Salty Balls, which got to number two. Do you know what got to number one that year?
Stick them in your mouth and suck them.
1998, it was Goodbye by the Spice Girls.
Oh, no.
This was in competition with the Spice Girls for Christmas number one.
Can I sing Goodbye by the Spice Girls? No, I can't. I can sing the Chocolate Salty Balls song.
Only because Goodbye just kind of goes, yeah, 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 yeah. Jerry's left and she's the one that had the better oomph.
Oh, that the video had all the wee...
That's the one, the claymation fairies.
Fairies, yeah. Except she was still in the video.
Because they'd recorded it before she,
I mean, I'm not a Spice Girls fan, but
we lived through the 90s.
So you couldn't move for Spice Girls.
We lived through Britain. You were a teenage girl in Britain in the 90s.
You couldn't move.
You couldn't avoid it.
Now, this is an important question that George and I have asked ourselves before. And I put it to you, listeners, to ask yourselves and send us in the all-important personality question.
Oh, God.
If you were a Spice Girl, what Spice Girl would you be and why? George is 100% Baby Spice.
I'm 100% Baby Spice. I'm glad that this role-playing game podcast is hitting the important questions, like which Spice Girl would you be? I'll work at character classes for the Spice Girls later, okay? That's only fair.
I feel Baby might have, Well, actually, only one of them's going to have levels in Bard, and that's going to be Mel C, because she's the only one that could sing.
Yeah, it's definitely not Victoria.
I'm totally posh Spice, right?
You're totally posh Spice.
I mean, I can sing a wee bit.
Number six. Oh, I just want you for my own, more than you could ever know. 1994 and 2020.
Well, it's not the Queen of Christmas, is it? Political.
Topical for the time. Because the person who performed this song tried to trademark the words Queen of Christmas to describe her, and a judge told her to sod off.
I mean, it's a giant publicity stunt, and I appreciate the hustle, but this was Mariah Carey, All I Want for Christmas Is You.
That's right.
A full mince pie for Elsa.
She's never got to number one with this song over the Christmas period. On original release, it was beaten by, yes, my bugbear again, it was beaten by Stay Another Day by East 17.
That's an all right song. At least it wasn't Cliff Richard.
And in 2020, it was beaten by Lad Babies, Don't Stop Me Eatin', which I believe had a remix with Ronan Keating.
Well, that just sounds like wallpaper for the ears.
Yeah. Number seven. Ain't About What's Waiting on the Other Side, It's the Climb, 2009.
Well, my musical knowledge pretty much ended around 2002, so I have absolutely no idea. I'm going to take a punt. It was Taylor Swift, because she does everything else.
Bit early for Taylor Swift, but okay, you got a song title in mind?
The Climb.
Ilse, you get half a mince pie. Really? Because the song is The Climb. It was by X Factor winner Joe McKeldry.
It blooming well would be.
The Climb was a song released earlier that year by Miley Cyrus for the Hannah Montana movie.
Oh, is this the year that they missed out the number one due to Rage Against the Machine?
This is. There had been four Christmas number ones in a row had been winners of reality TV show X Factor. So your American,
Simon Cowell.
American Idol equivalent. So you had Shane Ward, Leona Lewis, Lian Jackson and Alexandra Burke.
All who I'm sure are perfectly nice people in real life and perfectly competent singers. But that's really not the point. And after years of being force-fed this, the British public stood up and said no.
Well, I mean, to be exact, they said...
They said they would not do as you tell me.
Stuff you, I won't do what you tell
yes,
me.
Yes, that is exactly what they said.
And although having a couple of other X Factor winners of the number one slot, like Matt Cardle and Sam Bailey, it's been a lot more charity performers and stuff in recent years. Like, the hold was broken.
I mean, that kind of brings its own set of issues.
But... As we will not comment on any sausage roll-based millionaire cheating on their wife people for the purposes of this podcast.
Oh, George, you went there.
Oh, why does your role-playing game podcast get taken off air? Well, I slandered Lad Baby. So that's 5.5 for Ilsa, 5.5 mince pies.
That's doing all right.
Number eight. Now, do you want me to read this one out or do you want me to perform it as it's performed in the song?
I feel that we could all benefit from a George performance.
Number eight. I will be my put them with my own. Get me all over, built my dreams around you. I can't do it correctly because...
You've got too many teeth.
I actually have more teeth than people are supposed to have. I've got like four wisdom teeth. I had to have some removed because I'm running out of space. And the person that sang this song had...
Nitty.
So I'm never going to get it quite right, but I'm open to your suggestions.
Oh, that was a pretty pretty accurate rendition of A Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues and the late, great Kirsty MacColl.
That's correct. So yes, the correct lyric there was, of course, I kept them with me, babe.
I put them with my own.
Can't make it all alone. I built my dreams around you. And yes, that's Fairy Tale of New York, which... only got as far as number two on first release in 1987.
It was a grower, not a shower.
It was...
It's just, I was thinking there, I don't know if our American listeners or... we've got a couple in Canada now know what a bell end is.
Well, it's an educational experience.
Google it, but don't Google it at work.
Yeah, it was beaten in 1987 by the Pet Shop Boys, a British electronic dance music-y sort of... thing who did an Elvis cover, Always On My Mind.
Oh no, that is an absolute banger.
It is great.
It is really, it was a worthy number one.
Mr. Shane McGowan of the Pogues said some very uncomplimentary things back in the day when he lost.
I'm sure he did. I'm sure that he was probably high as a kite at the time.
He did a lot of drugs, ladies and gentlemen. That's part of why he had no teeth. And he referred to the Pet Shop Boys as, quote, Christmas fairies, end quote.
I mean, that's actually quite, quite lucid.
Anyway, let's move on before the inch high incel turned up to complain about them changing the lyrics of Fairy Tale of New York, even though while Kirsty MacColl was alive, she would perform them differently because she also didn't like saying that word.
Yeah. More mince pies! More mince pies! Yeah,
6.5. Number 9. Well, baby, I've been here before. I've seen this room and I've walked this floor. You know I used to live alone before I knew you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is number 2 in 2008. And I am messing with Ailsa heavily because the number 1 song in 2008 was also the number 1 song in 2008, performed by two different people.
Oh.
But.
Right,
but
let's see where this is going.
They had very slightly different lyrics because it's a song that had enough lyrics to spare.
This is Hallelujah, isn't it?
So yeah, so Alexandra Burke, one of those X Factor winners we mentioned earlier, she had a number 1 this year. In 2008 with Hallelujah. But another version of the song was re-released and pushed out and got as far as number 2.
Okay, so I'm honestly not sure about this. I know the song was originally written by miserablest Leonard Cohen.
Did love a grumble.
Was it his own version or was it the Jeff Buckley version?
That's a tough call, ladies.
Because I think this is an other rebelling against the Simon Cowell machine.
Yes.
Wanted to get a better version.
Because it's the year before.
Nothing against Alexandra Burke. She's got a lovely voice.
I actually saw an interview with her once where she was talking about how she was convinced she wasn't going to get the Christmas number one because she was doing a song that was so wonderful that she thought she could never do it justice. That she basically, the moment they told her that's what you're doing, she was like,
oh no,
I'm doomed!
So I think they've actually re-released the Jeff Buckley version because in its own way it's probably better known.
It did appear in the film Shrek.
Oh, true, yeah.
And it also got to number 2 in the charts in 2008. Ailsa, you're right!
Woo!
7.5 mince pies for you.
Yes. I'm going to go into a sugar coma.
Okay. One last one. This is 1996. Another year where the Spice Girls got to number 1 with a song we did in the last quiz, Two Become One. But this is the song that was at number 2. I want song and artist.
Okay.
Number 10. And all the roads that lead you there are winding, and all the lights that light the way are blinding. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't see me, but I want you to imagine that I've just waggled my eyebrows up and down 3 times. I might put something on in Foley, or maybe if I do it close enough to the microphone, you can hear. And all the roads that lead you there are winding, and all the lights that light the way are blinding.
See, this is a song by my least favourite band of all time, Oasis. I don't like them. I don't care if I've offended any listeners. I seriously dislike them and everything they stand for.
What if you'd like to listen to Oasis, but you haven't heard them before, why not simply get a Beatles album and put a bucket over your heads and, yeah, play the Beatles album, you'll get more or less the same experience. What is the title of the song, Ailsa?
It's Wonderwall.
Okay. And who do you think got to number 2 in 1996 with Wonderwall? There's that wiggle sound effect again.
Now, one would think the obvious one is Oasis.
I would absolutely end the quiz in a really easy, obvious one. But Ailsa, that sounds like the structure that we follow on this show.
But I've got a funny feeling that there was a cover version of this by Mike Flowers Pops, which I got into a lot of trouble at school and made no friends for saying I preferred his cover to the original.
So Mike Flowers Pops, for the benefit of, well, I mean, not even anyone now, just anybody who wasn't a very specific age, did...
Imagine if Austin Powers was covering stuff.
He did sort of easy listening-y, loungy covers of songs. There was a kind
not
of...
Not quite Richard Cheese.
Not quite. There was a easy listening phase in the early to mid-90s. The wonderful Tim Worthington of Looks Unfamiliar has talked about this before. And he was part of this vanguard. And that included covers of several songs, Do you think the one that got a number two was his version?
I hope so.
Ilsa, you had 7.5 mince pies.
Yep.
You now have 8.5 mince pies.
Yes! Yes! Whoop, 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 whoop!
The BBC, I think in particular Chris Evans, thought this cover version, again, of a band who often aped the Beatles, somebody made a kind of 50s, 60s sounding cover of a 90s song that was trying to sound like a 60s song, which is this weird Ouroboros situation that led to a kind of joke in the promotion of the song that they would talk about it as though it was the original 60s version that had been covered, that had been like dug out of the archives.
Yeah, sorry again to any Oasis fans. Actually, you know what? I'm not sorry. They suck. They were rubbish. They're utterly boring and I dislike them intensely.
They actually, well, it's funny you mention Austin Powers. He was actually on the Austin Powers International Man of Mystery soundtrack. And their other covers they did included Light My Fire, Please Release Me, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. It was number two in 1990s charts. It got to number one in Scotland.
Yes.
We
got the joke.
Anyway, we've now got, you now have to eat 8.5 mince pies.
I can do that, nay bother.
And I've got to work out what to do with 1.5 other mince pies. We share an office with Twike. I'm sure we can get rid of them. And that's really the end of the episode. Thanks for listening, everyone, and thank you all for bearing with us while we took some time off. We hope you've enjoyed this festive bumper episode, and we look forward to giving you some more content in 2023.
Don't forget to subscribe on the podcast app of your choice, and we'd appreciate it if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, or Spotify.
You can contact us via email on tilldicepodcast@gmail.com with any questions or feedback you might have for us. Let us know what you want to hear more about or if there's any other games you'd like us to review. You can also follow and message us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Tilldice Podcast, where Twike the Social Goblin posts additional content.
Our theme tune is Funny Adventures by Winnie the Moog, and additional music this episode was Xmas in the House by Frank Schurter.
Schurter?
Frank Schurter. Frank. And Acid Trumpet by Kevin MacLeod. These were all used under Creative Commons Attribution License. Our logo was created by Neil Slorens. His website is neilslorens.com.
If you're enjoying the show and feeling full of the Christmas spirit, you can help support us by buying a virtual coffee at ko-fi.com/tilldicepodcast. Your money helps pay for the hosting fees and the emergency packets of Twinkies.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, we hope you all have a lovely Christmas and New Year, however you choose to celebrate, and we hope that Santa brings you a Twike minifigure in your stocking.
If not, you can totally buy one for yourselves at Ramshackle Games. Check out our link tree or social media for further details.
Bye! Bye.